Moore House Hotel, where the event is being held. This weekend is the literary Super Bowl, and she's buzzing. We are on our way to a dinner where 10 authors will get to know one another before we head into the ballroom and pitch our upcoming books from the stage. This dinner, which I have just learned about a few hours before, has heightened my introvert terror alert level from yellow to red. The room where the authors are to have dinner is small, with two long conference tables pushed together to form a square. Instead of sitting, people are milling. Milling with people I do not know is my idea of hell on earth. I do not mill. I walk over to the drink table and pour an ice water. A famous writer walks over and introduces herself. She asks, "Are you Glennon? I've been wanting to talk to you. You're the Christian one, right?" "Yes, I'm the one." "My new book is about a woman who has a religious experience and becomes a Christian. Do you believe it? A Christian. It feels so real to her. I don't know how my readers will react. Will people be able to take her seriously? What do you think? Do you feel like people take you seriously?" I say the most serious thing I can think of and then excuse myself. I look at the table. No assigned seats, damn it. George Saunders sits quietly at the end of the table. He seems gentle and kind, and I'd like to sit next to him, but he is a man, and I don't know how to talk to men. At the end of the table is a young woman with calm energy. I sit down next to her. She is a 20-something releasing her first children's book. I ask her question after question while considering how wonderful it would be if the organizers would just place our books on the table so we could get to know each other by reading silently. We butter our rolls. Salads are served. As I'm reaching for dressing, the children's book lady looks over at the door. I look over too. Suddenly, a woman is standing where nothingness used to be. She takes up the entire doorway, the entire room, the entire universe. She has short hair, platinum on top, shaved on the sides. She's wearing a long trench coat, a red scarf, a warm half smile, cool steel confidence. She stands still there for a moment, taking inventory of the room. I stare at her and take inventory of my entire life. My whole being says, "There she is." Then I lose control of my body. I stand up and open my arms wide. She looks over, cocks her head to the side, raises her eyebrows, smiles at me. "Fuck, fuck, fuck, why am I standing? Why are my arms open? Oh my God, what am I doing?" I sit back down. She walks around the table and shakes everyone's hands. When she gets to me, I stand up again, turn around, face her. "I'm Abby," she says. I ask if I can hug her because what if this is my only chance? She smiles and opens her arms. Then, the smell that will become home to me, skin like powder and fabric softener blended with the wool of her coat and her cologne and something that smelled like air, like outdoors, like crisp sky, like a baby and a woman and a man and the whole world. The only seat left is at the far end of the table, so she walks away from me and sits down. She'll later tell me that she didn't eat or speak because all of her energy was spent trying not to stare. Mine too. Dinner ends and there is more milling. Oh my God, more milling, and now with a revolution in the room? I excuse myself to go to the bathroom and kill 2 milling minutes. When I walk out, she is standing in the hallway, watching the bathroom door, waiting. She motions to me to come over. I look behind me to make sure it's me she's talking to. She laughs. She laughs. Then it's time to walk to the ballroom. We separate ourselves from the pack somehow. There are people 3 feet in front of us and behind us, but here we are, walking alone together. I want so badly to be interesting. But she is so cool, and I don't know how to be cool. I've not been cool a day in my life. I am warm, burning up, sweating through my shirt already. She starts talking, thank God. She tells me about the book she's about to release. She says, "But things are hard right now. You've probably heard." Heard what? I have not heard. What would I have heard, and where would I have heard it? She says, the news, maybe? ESPN? No. I have not heard the news on ESPN, I say. She speaks slowly at first, then all at once. I'm a soccer player, was a soccer player. I just retired and I'm not sure what I am now. I got a DUI last month. It was all over the news. I watched my mugshot scroll across the ticker for days. I can't believe I did it. I've been really lost and depressed the last couple of years and I screwed up. I've always been about honor and I ruined my whole legacy. I let everybody down. I hurt the whole team, maybe. And now they want me to write my book as some kind of hero, athlete, puff piece. But I keep thinking, what if I'm just honest? What if I write the truth about my life? I am sad for her, but I am thrilled for me. In our 4 minutes together, she has asked me about the three subjects I know best: drinking, writing, and shame. This is my jam. I've got this. Hot damn. I put my hand on her arm. Electrical currents. I pull back and recover enough to say, listen, I have a rap sheet as long as your arm. I'd write it all. I'd be honest. I don't know much about the sports world, but I do know that out here in the real world, we like real people. She stops walking, so I do too. She turns and looks directly at me. It appears that she's about to say something. I hold my breath. Then she turns and keeps walking. I start breathing and walking too. We enter the ballroom and follow the other authors through a sea of round tables, white tablecloths, 30-foot ceilings, crystal chandeliers. We end up at the dais, climb the stairs, and see that we've been seated next to each other. We walk toward our places, and when we arrive, she puts her hand on the back of my chair. She cannot decide whether to pull it out for me. She does. Thank you, I say. We sit down, and the writer seated next to Abby asks where she's from. We live in Portland, Abby answers. The writer says, oh, I love Portland. Abby says, yeah. Something about the way she says yeah makes me listen very, very hard. I don't know how much longer I'll be there. We moved there because we thought it would be a good place to raise a family. I can tell just by the way she says this that there is no we left. I want to save her from follow-up questions, so I say, oh, people like us can't live in Portland. We're Portland on the inside. We need sunshine on the outside. I am immediately embarrassed by what I've just said. Portland on the inside? What the hell do those words even mean? People like us? Why did I say us? Us? How terribly presumptuous to suggest the concept of us. 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 She looks at me. Her eyes widen and she smiles. I change my mind. I don't know what I meant, but I'm glad I said it. I decide that heaven is saying anything that makes this woman smile like that. The event begins. When it is my turn to walk to the podium and speak, I disregard half of my planned speech and say things about shame and freedom that I want Abby to hear. I look at the hundreds of people in front of me and think only of her behind me. When I finish, I sit down and Abby looks at me. Her eyes are red. The dinner ends and people begin to approach our table. A line forms in front of Abby, 50 people deep. She turns and asks me to sign a copy of my book for her. I do. Then she turns back toward the crowd and starts smiling, signing, making small talk. She is comfortable, confident, gracious. She is used to this. A curly-haired woman who had walked into dinner behind Abby approaches our table. I can tell she is waiting to talk to me. I smile and motion her over. She leans into me as close as possible and whispers, I'm sorry, I've never done anything like this before. I know Abby really well, like a sister. I don't know what happened here in the last hour, but I've never seen her like this. I really feel like she needs you in her life. Somehow. This is so weird. I'm sorry. This woman is flustered and she has tears in her eyes. She hands me her business card. and I understand that my answer will be important to her. I say, okay, yes, yes, of course. My friend Dina from my publishing house is waiting so that we can walk out together. I look over at Abby, still 40 fans left to sign for. I am not sad to leave Abby. I am excited to leave her so I can think about her. I'm excited to leave because I realize I have never in my life felt this alive. And now I just want to go out into the world and walk around feeling this alive. I just want to start being this new person I have just suddenly, somehow, become. I say, bye, Abby. Oh my God, I've said her name. Abby. I wonder if it's okay or if I should have asked permission to use this word that sends shockwaves rippling through me. She turns toward me, smiles, waves. She looks expectant. Her face is asking a question that one day I'll answer. Dina and I walk out of the ballroom and into a grand hallway. She stops me and asks, how do you think it went? I say, it was amazing. Dina says, I agree. You were on fire up there. Different somehow. Oh, you meant the speech. I was talking about the whole night. I felt the oddest thing. I felt like Abby and I had some kind of connection. Dina grabbed my arm and said, I cannot believe you just said that. I can't believe this. I swear to God, I felt it too. I felt something happening between you from all the way in the back of the ballroom. This is so wild. I stared at her and said, it was. It is. This whole night, the connection between us, it was just like... Dina looked hard at me and then said, like you two would have been together in another life? Part 2. Keys. Dropping keys. The small woman builds cages for everyone she knows, while the sage, who has to duck her head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful, rowdy prisoners. Hafiz. I was never completely gone. My spark was always inside me, smoldering. But I sure as hell felt gone for a long while. My childhood bulimia morphed into alcoholism and drug use, and I stayed numb for 16 years. Then, when I was 26, I got pregnant and sober. Sobriety was the field in which I began to remember my wild. It went like this. I began building the kind of life a woman is supposed to build. I became a good wife, mother, daughter, Christian, citizen, writer, woman. But while I made school lunches, wrote memoirs, rushed through airports, made small talk with neighbors, carried on with my outer life, I felt an electric restlessness buzzing inside me. It was like constant thunder rolling right there beneath my skin. A thunder made of joy and pain and rage and longing and love too deep, scalding and tender for this world. It felt like hot water simmering, always threatening to boil. I was afraid of what was inside me. It felt powerful enough to destroy every bit of the lovely life I'd built. Like how I never feel safe on a balcony because what if I jump? It's okay, I told myself. I'll keep myself and my people safe by keeping my insides hidden. I was amazed at how easy this was. I was filled with electric thunder, simmering water, fiery red and gold, but all I had to do was smile and nod, and the world would take me for easy breezy blue. Sometimes I wondered if I wasn't the only one using her skin to contain herself. Maybe we are all fire wrapped in skin, trying to look cool. My boiling point was the moment Abby stepped through that doorway. I looked at her, and I could no longer contain myself. I lost control. Fire red, golden, rolling bubbles of pain and love and longing filled me, brought me to my feet, threw my arms open wide, insisting, there she is. For a long while, I thought what happened that day was some kind of fairy tale magic. I thought the words, there she is, came to me from on high. Now I know that "There she is" came from within. That wild rowdiness that had simmered for so long and then turned itself into words and lifted me was me. The voice I finally heard that day was my own. The girl I'd locked away at 10 years old, the girl I was before the world told me who to be. And she said, "Here I am. I'm taking over now." When I was a child, I felt what I needed to feel, and I followed my gut, and I planned only from my imagination. I was wild until I was tamed by shame. Until I started hiding and numbing my feelings for fear of being too much. Until I started deferring to others' advice instead of trusting my own intuition. Until I became convinced that my imagination was ridiculous and my desires were selfish. Until I surrendered myself to the cages of others' expectations, cultural mandates, and institutional allegiances. I lost myself when I learned how to please. Sobriety was my painstaking resurrection. It was my return to wild. It was one long remembering. It was realizing that the hot electric thunder I felt buzzing and rolling inside was me, trying to get my attention, begging me to remember, insisting I'm still in here. So I finally unlocked and unleashed her. I set free my beautiful, rowdy, true, wild self. I was right about her power. It was too big for the life I was living. So I systematically dismantled every piece of it. Then I built a life of my own. I did it by resurrecting the very parts of myself I was trained to mistrust, hide, and abandon in order to keep others comfortable. My emotions, my intuition, my imagination, my courage. Those are the keys to freedom. Those are who we are. Will we be brave enough to unlock ourselves? Will we be brave enough to set ourselves free? Will we finally step out of our cages and say to ourselves, to our people, and to the world, "Here I am"? Feel. Key one, feel it all. On my sixth day of sobriety, I went to my fifth recovery meeting. I sat in a cold plastic seat, trembling, trying to keep the coffee from spilling out of my paper cup and my feelings from spilling out of my skin. For 16 years, I had made damn sure that nothing touched me. And suddenly, everything in the world was touching me. I was an exposed nerve. Everything hurt. I was embarrassed to tell anyone how much I hurt, but I decided to try to explain it to the people in that circle. They were the first people I trusted with all of me because they were the first people I ever heard tell the whole truth. They had shown me their insides, so I showed them mine. I said something like, "I'm Glennon, and I've been sober for 6 days. I feel awful. I think this awfulness is why I started drinking in the first place. I'm starting to worry that what was wrong with me wasn't the booze, it was underneath it. It was me. It doesn't seem like being alive is as hard for other people as it is for me. It just feels like there's some kind of secret to life I don't know, like I'm doing it all wrong. Thanks for listening." After the meeting ended, a woman walked over and sat down next to me. She said, "Thanks for sharing. I relate. I just wanted to tell you something that somebody told me in the beginning. It's okay to feel all the stuff you're feeling. You're just becoming human again. You're not doing life wrong. You're doing it right. If there's any secret you're missing, it's that doing it right is just really hard. Feeling all your feelings is hard, but that's what they're for. Feelings are for feeling. All of them, even the hard ones. The secret is that you're doing it right, and that doing it right hurts sometimes." I did not know before that woman told me that all feelings were for feeling. I did not know that I was supposed to feel everything. I thought I was supposed to feel happy. I thought that happy was for feeling, and that pain was for fixing and numbing and deflecting and hiding and ignoring. I thought that when life got hard, it was because I had gone wrong somewhere. I thought that pain was weakness and that I was supposed to suck it up. But the thing was that the more I sucked it up, the more food and booze I had to suck down. That day, I began returning to myself, fearful and trembling, pregnant and 6 days sober, in a church basement with shitty fluorescent lights and terrible coffee, when a kind woman revealed to me that being fully human is not about feeling happy. It's about feeling everything. From that day forward, I began to practice feeling it all. I began to insist upon my right and responsibility to feel it all, even when taking the time and energy for feeling made me a little less efficient, a little less convenient, a little less pleasant. In the past 18 years, I have learned two things about pain. First, I can feel everything and survive. What I thought would kill me didn't. Every time I said to myself, I can't take this anymore, I was wrong. The truth was that I could and did take it all, and I kept surviving. Surviving again and again made me less afraid of myself, of other people, of life. I learned that I'd never be free from pain, but I could be free from the fear of pain, and that was enough. I finally stopped avoiding fires long enough to let myself burn, and what I learned was that I am like that burning bush. The fire of pain won't consume me. I can burn and burn and live. I can live on fire. I am fireproof. Second, I can use pain to become. I am here to keep becoming truer, more beautiful versions of myself again and again forever. To be alive is to be in a perpetual state of revolution. Whether I like it or not, pain is the fuel of revolution. Everything I need to become the woman I'm meant to be next is inside my feelings of now. Life is alchemy, and emotions are the fire that turns me to gold. I will continue to become only if I resist extinguishing myself a million times a day. If I can sit in the fire of my own feelings, I will keep becoming. Consumer culture promises us that we can buy our way out of pain, that the reason we're sad and angry is not that being human hurts, it's because we don't have those countertops, her thighs, these jeans. This is a clever way to run an economy, but it is no way to run a life. Consuming keeps us distracted, busy, and numb. Numbness keeps us from becoming. This is why every great spiritual teacher tells us the same story about humanity and pain. Don't avoid it. You need it to evolve, to become, and you are here to become. Like Buddha, who had to leave his life of comfort to experience all kinds of human suffering before finding enlightenment. Like Moses, who wandered 40 years in the desert before seeing the promised land. Like Wesley from The Princess Bride, who said, "Life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says differently is selling something." Like Jesus, who walked straight toward his own crucifixion. First the pain, then the waiting, then the rising. All of our suffering comes when we try to get to our resurrection without allowing ourselves to be crucified first. There is no glory except straight through your story. Pain is not tragic. Pain is magic. Suffering is tragic. Suffering is what happens when we avoid pain and consequently miss our becoming. That is what I can and must avoid. Missing my own evolution because I am too afraid to surrender to the process. Having such little faith in myself that I numb or hide or consume my way out of my fiery feelings again and again. So my goal is to stop abandoning myself and stay. To trust that I'm strong enough to handle the pain that is necessary to the process of becoming. Because what scares me a hell of a lot more than pain is living my entire life and missing my becoming. What scares me more than feeling it all is missing it all. These days, when pain comes, there are two of me. There is the me that is miserable and afraid, and there is the me that is curious and and excited. That me is not a masochist. She's wise. She remembers. She remembers that even though I can't know what will come next in my life, I always know what comes next in the process. I know that when the pain and the waiting are here, the rising is on its way. I hope the pain will pass soon, but I'll wait it out because I've tested pain enough to trust it. And because who I will become tomorrow is so unforeseeable and specific that I'll need every bit of today's lessons to become her. I keep a note stuck to my bathroom mirror. Feel it all. It reminds me that although I began to come back to life 18 years ago, I resurrect myself every day, in every moment that I allow myself to feel and become. It's my daily reminder to let myself burn to ashes and rise new. Know. Key 2, be still and know. Several years ago, very early one morning, I found myself unable to sleep again. It was 3 a.m. and I was wild-eyed, shaky, flailing, grasping for answers like a drowning woman desperate for air. I had just typed these words into my Google search window. What should I do if my husband is a cheater, but also an amazing dad? I stared at that question and thought, well, I have hit some sort of new rock bottom. I've just asked the internet to make the most important and personal decision of my life. Why do I trust everyone else on earth more than I trust myself? Where the hell is myself? When did I lose touch with her? I clicked on article after article anyway. Distressingly, everyone thought I should do something different. The religious experts insisted that a good Christian would stay. Feminists argued that a strong woman would leave. Parenting articles preached that a good mother thinks only of what is best for her children. All of those differing opinions meant that I quite literally could not please everyone. That was a relief. When a woman finally learns that pleasing the world is impossible, she becomes free to learn how to please herself. I looked at all of those contradictory opinions and thought, if there is, in fact, an objective right or wrong way to handle this, why do all of these people have such different ideas about what a person should do? I had an epiphany. It must be that should and shouldn't, right and wrong, good and bad, they're not wild. They're not real. They're just culturally constructed, artificial, ever-changing cages created to maintain institutions. It struck me that in every family, culture, or religion, ideas of right and wrong are the hot cattle prods, the barking sheepdogs that keep the masses in the herd. They are the bars that keep us caged. I decided that if I kept doing the right thing, I would spend my life following someone else's directions instead of my own. I didn't want to live my life without living my life. I wanted to make my own decision as a free woman from my soul, not my training. But the problem was, I didn't know how. A few weeks later, I opened a card from a friend that said, in bold, capital, thick, black lettering, "Be still and know." I'd read that verse many times before, but it struck me freshly this time. It didn't say, poll your friends and know, or read books by experts and know, or scour the internet and know. It suggested a different approach to knowing. Just stop. Stop moving, stop talking, stop searching, stop panicking, stop flailing. If you just stop doing, you'll start knowing. This seemed like magical nonsense, but desperate women take desperate measures. I decided to experiment. After the kids left for school, I shut myself in the closet, sat down on a towel, closed my eyes, and did nothing but breathe. At first, each 10-minute session felt 10 hours long. I checked my phone every few moments. I planned my grocery lists and mentally redecorated my living room. The only things I seemed to know on that floor were that I was hungry and itchy and suddenly desperate to fold laundry and reorganize my pantry. I was an input junkie thrown into detox. I was tempted to quit every second, but I was stern with myself. 10 minutes a day is not too long to spend finding yourself, Glennon. For God's sake, you spend 80 minutes a day finding your keys. After a few weeks, like a gymnast who is able to stretch deeper after each training, I began to feel myself dropping lower during each closet session. Eventually, I sank deep enough to find a new level inside me that I'd never known existed. This place is underneath, low, deep, quiet, still. There are no voices there, not even my own. All I can hear down there is my breath. It was as though I'd been drowning, and in my panic, I had been gasping for air, calling for rescue, and flailing on the surface. But what I really needed to do to save myself was let myself sink. It struck me that this is why we say to people, calm down, because beneath the noise of the pounding, swirling surf is a place where all is quiet and clear. Since the chaos stills in this deep, I could sense something there I was not able to sense on the surface. It was like that silent chamber in Denmark, one of the quietest places in the world, where people can actually hear and feel their own blood circulating. There in the deep, I could sense something circulating inside me. It was a knowing. I can know things down at this level that I can't on the chaotic surface. Down here, when I pose a question about my life in words or abstract images, I sense a nudge. The nudge guides me toward the next precise thing. And then, when I silently acknowledge the nudge, it fills me. The knowing feels like warm liquid gold filling my veins and solidifying just enough to make me feel steady, certain. What I learned, even though I'm afraid to say it, is that God lives in this deepness inside me. When I recognize God's presence and guidance, God celebrates by flooding me with warm, liquid gold. Every day, I return to the closet, sat down on the floor littered with t-shirts and jeans, and I practiced sinking. The knowing would meet me in the deep and nudge me toward the next right thing, one thing at a time. That was how I began to know what to do next. That was how I began to walk through my life more clearly, solid, and steady. A year later, I found myself in the middle of a work meeting, sitting at a long conference table. We were discussing an important decision that had to be made, and the team was looking to me for leadership. I felt uncertain. I was about to fall back into my old way of knowing, looking outward for acceptance, permission, and consensus. But when I glanced over and caught sight of the door to the supply closet, I remembered my new way of knowing. I wondered if the team would mind if I excused myself to spend a few minutes in that closet. Instead, I took a deep breath, and with eyes wide open, I turned inward and tried to sink right there at the table. It worked. I sensed the nudge, and as soon as I acknowledged it, I was filled with warm liquid gold. I rose back to the surface, smiled, and said, "I know what to do." I calmly and assuredly told the others the thing I wanted us to do. The panic in the room settled. Everyone breathed and seemed instantly relaxed and steady. We moved on. God came out of the closet, and now I can take God anywhere. I now take orders only from my own knowing. Whether I'm presented with a work, personal, or family decision, a monumental or tiny decision, whenever uncertainty rises, I sink. I sink beneath the swirling surf of words, fear, expectations, conditioning, and advice, and feel for the knowing. I sink 100 times a day. I have to, because the knowing never reveals a 5-year plan. It feels to me like a loving, playful guide, like the reason it will only reveal the next right thing is that it wants me to come back again and again because it wants to do life together. After many years, I'm developing a relationship with this knowing. We are learning to trust each other. When I talk like this, my wife raises her eyebrow and asks, "Aren't you just talking to yourself down there?" Maybe. If what I found in the deep is just myself, if what I've learned is not how to commune with God, but how to commune with myself, if who I have learned to trust is not God, but myself, and if for the rest of my life, no matter how lost I get, I know exactly where and how to find myself again, well then, that is certainly enough of a miracle for me. Why do we worry about what to call the knowing instead of sharing with each other how to call the knowing? I know many people who have found this level inside them and live solely by it. Some call the knowing God or wisdom or intuition or source or deepest self. I have a friend with some serious God issues, and she calls it Sebastian. A God by any other name is an equal miracle and relief. It doesn't matter what we call our knowing. What matters, if we want to live our singular shooting star of a life, is that we call it. I have learned that if I want to rise, I have to sink first. I have to search for and depend upon the voice of inner wisdom instead of voices of outer approval. This saves me from living someone else's life. It also saves me a hell of a lot of time and energy. I just do the next thing the knowing guides me toward, one thing at a time. I don't ask permission first, which is just such a grown-up way to live. The best part is this: the knowing is beyond and beneath language, so I have no language to use to translate it to anyone. Since it doesn't use words to explain itself to me, I quit using words to explain myself to the world. This is the most revolutionary thing a woman can do. The next precise thing, one thing at a time. Without asking permission or offering explanation. This way of life is thrilling. I understand now that no one else in the world knows what I should do. The experts don't know, the ministers, the therapists, the magazines, the authors, my parents, my friends, they don't know. Not even the folks who love me the most. Because no one has ever lived or will ever live this life I am attempting to live with my gifts and challenges and past and people. Every life is an unprecedented experiment. This life is mine alone. So I have stopped asking people for directions to places they've never been. There is no map. We are all pioneers. I've got the second key tattooed on my wrist. Be still. It's my daily reminder that if I am willing to sit in the stillness with myself, I always know what to do. That the answers are never out there. They are as close as my breath and as steady as my heartbeat. All I have to do is stop flailing, sink below the surface, and feel for the nudge and the gold. Then I have to trust it, no matter how illogical or scary the next right thing seems. Because the more consistently, bravely and precisely I follow the inner knowing, the more precise and beautiful my outer life becomes. The more I live by my own knowing, the more my life becomes my own, and the less afraid I become. I trust that the knowing will go with me wherever I go, nudging me toward the next thing, one thing at a time, guiding me all the way home. How to know. Moment of uncertainty arises. Breathe. Turn inward. Sink. Feel around for the knowing. Do the next thing it nudges you toward. Let it stand. Don't explain. Repeat forever. And for the rest of your life, continue to shorten the gap between the knowing and the doing. Imagine. Key 3, dare to imagine. When I was 26 years old, I found myself sitting on a dirty bathroom floor holding a positive pregnancy test. I stared at the little blue cross and thought, well, this is impossible. There could not be a worse candidate for motherhood on earth. I'd binged and purged several times a day for 16 years. I'd been drinking myself to blackout every night for the previous 7. I'd destroyed my liver, my credit, my record, my tooth enamel, and all of my relationships. My aching head, the empty beer bottles on the floor, my bank account, my ringless, trembling fingers, they all screamed, "No, not you." Yet something inside me whispered, "Yes, me." All evidence to the contrary, I could imagine myself as a sober, thriving mother. I became sober, and then I became a mother, a wife, and a writer. Fast forward 14 years. Reminder, I'm 40 years old now. I've got one husband, two dogs, and three children who adore their father. I also have a skyrocketing writing career based partly on my traditional family and Christianity. I'm at an event to launch my new book, the highly anticipated memoir about my marriage's redemption. At that event, a woman walks into the room, and I look at her and fall madly in love within the same moment. My circumstances, my fear, my religion, my career, they all scream, "No, not her." And yet something inside me whispered, "Yes, her." The something inside me was my imagination. All evidence to the contrary, I could imagine myself as Abby's partner. The facts were right there in front of me to see, but the truth was right there inside of me to feel. Swelling, pressing, insisting, there is a life meant for you that is truer than the one you're living. But in order to have it, you will have to forge it yourself. You will have to create on the outside what you are imagining on the inside. Only you can bring it forth. And it will cost you everything. I've learned to live by faith, which does not mean that I live by a set of unwavering beliefs or dogma that men laid down ages ago to keep their power by controlling others. My faith has nothing to do with religion anymore. To me, living by faith is allowing the swelling and pressing inside me to direct my outward words and decisions. Because to me, God is not a being outside of me. God is the fire, the nudge, the warm liquid gold swelling and pressing inside me. In fact, my favorite idea of faith is a belief in the unseen order of things. There are two orders of things. There is the seen order unfolding in front of us every day on our streets and in the news. In this visible order, violence reigns and children are shot in their schools and warmongers prosper and 1% of the world hoards half of all we have. We call this order of things reality. This is the way things are. It's all we can see because it's all we've ever seen, yet something inside us rejects it. We know instinctively, this is not the intended order of things. This is not how things are meant to be. We know that there is a better, truer, wilder way. That better way is the unseen order inside us. It is the vision we carry in our imagination about a truer, more beautiful world, one in which all children have enough to eat, and we no longer kill each other, and mothers do not have to cross deserts with their babies on their backs. This better idea is what Jews call shalom, Buddhists call nirvana, Christians call heaven, Muslims call salam, and many agnostics call peace. It is not a place out there, not yet. It's the hopeful swelling in here, pressing through our skin, insisting that it was all meant to be more beautiful than this. And it can be, if we refuse to wait to die and go to heaven, and instead find heaven inside us and give birth to it here and now. If we work to make the vision of the unseen order swelling inside us visible in our lives, homes, and nations, we will make reality more beautiful, on earth as it is in heaven, in our material world as it is in our imagination. Tabitha. She was born into captivity. The only visible order she's ever known includes cages and dirty pink bunnies and weak, bored applause. Tabitha never knew the wild. Yet Tabitha knew the wild. It was in her. She sensed the pressing of the unseen order like a relentless hunch. Perhaps for us, as for Tabitha, the deepest truth is not what we can see, but what we can imagine. Perhaps imagination is not where we go to escape reality, but where we go to remember it. Perhaps when we want to know the original plan for our lives, families, world, we should consult not what's in front of us, but what's inside us. Imagination is how personal and worldwide revolutions begin. "I have a dream," said Martin Luther King Jr. "Dreaming, after all, is a form of planning," said Gloria Steinem. In order to move our culture forward, revolutionaries have had to speak and plan from the unseen order inside them. For those not consulted in the building of the visible order, igniting imagination is the only way to see beyond what was created to leave us out. If those who were not part of the building of reality only consult reality for possibilities, reality will never change. We will keep shuffling and competing for a seat at their table instead of building our own tables. We will keep banging our heads on their glass ceilings instead of pitching our own huge tent outside. We will remain caged by this world instead of taking our rightful place as co-creators of it. Each of us was born to bring forth something that has never existed. A way of being, a family, an idea, art, a community, something brand new. We are here to fully introduce ourselves, to impose ourselves and ideas and thoughts and dreams onto the world, leaving it changed forever by who we are and what we bring forth from our depths. So we cannot contort ourselves to fit into the visible order. We must unleash ourselves and watch the world reorder itself in front of our eyes. My job is to listen deeply to women. What many tell me is that they harbor an achy, heavy hunch that their lives, relationships, and world were meant to be more beautiful than they are. They ask, "Shouldn't my marriage feel more loving than this? Shouldn't my religion be more alive and kind than this? Shouldn't my work be more meaningful and my community be more connected? Shouldn't the world I'm leaving to my babies be less brutal? Isn't it all just supposed to be more beautiful than this?" The women asking these questions remind me of Tabitha. They are stalking the periphery of their lives, feeling discontent. To me, this is exciting. Because discontent is the nagging of the imagination. Discontent is evidence that your imagination has not given up on you. It is still pressing, swelling, trying to get your attention by whispering, "Not this." Not this is a very important stage. But knowing what we do not want is not the same as knowing what we do want. So how can we get from not this to this instead? How can we move from feeling discontent to creating new lives and new worlds? In other words, how can we begin to live from our imagination instead of our indoctrination? Language is my favorite tool, so I use it to help people build a bridge between what's in front of them and what's inside them. I have learned that if we want to hear the voice of imagination, we must speak to it in the language it understands. If we want to know who we were meant to be, before the world told us who to be. If we want to know where we were meant to go before we were put in our place, if we want to taste freedom instead of control, then we must relearn our soul's native tongue. When women write to me in the language of indoctrination, when they use words like good and should and right and wrong, I try to speak back to them in the language of imagination. We are all bilingual. We speak the language of indoctrination. But our native tongue is the language of imagination. When we use the language of indoctrination with its should and shouldn't, right and wrong, good and bad, we are activating our minds. That's not what we're going for here, because our minds are polluted by our training. In order to get beyond our training, we need to activate our imaginations. Our minds are excuse makers. Our imaginations are storytellers. So instead of asking ourselves what's right or wrong, we must ask ourselves what is true and beautiful. Then our imagination rises inside us, thanks us for finally consulting it after all these years, and tells us a story. Claire wrote to me recently. She's a lawyer and the daughter of an alcoholic. When she sat down to email me, she had just woken up, still woozy from her nightly take-the-edge-off glasses of wine. She wrote that she spends most of her time numb or foggy or ashamed. "Gee, I feel like I'm wasting my life," she wrote. "What should I do?" "Claire," I wrote, "what is the truest, most beautiful story about your life you can imagine?" Sasha wrote to tell me about her marriage. She married a guy who was distant and cold, just like her father had been. Sasha spent most of her days hustling to earn her husband's love, just like her mom had done to earn her dad's. She wrote, "I'm so tired and lonely. What's the right thing to do here?" I replied, "Sasha, can you tell me a story about the truest, most beautiful marriage you can imagine?" Danielle, a 34-year-old former kindergarten teacher, wrote to me recently. She spends her days and nights watching her 7-year-old die slowly in her arms, tortured by the same disease that killed her first son 3 years ago. Night and day, she sits by her son's bedside, feeding him, singing to him, soothing him. "I'm broken, Glennon," she wrote. "I don't know what to do." I wrote back, "Danielle, what is the truest, most beautiful story you can imagine about a mother and her sons?" Each of them replied to me. Claire wrote a story about a woman who never abandoned herself, who faced life on life's terms and was present for herself, her people, her life. She believed in that vision enough to begin therapy and to safely let rise to the surface all the pain she was trying to drown out with wine. Months later, she wrote to say that her new way of being is harder than ever, but it's the right kind of hard. She's not missing her own life anymore. When she looks at herself in the mirror, she no longer needs to look away. She is now a woman who can look into her own eyes. Sasha spent several evenings writing a story about the truest, most beautiful marriage she could imagine. She spent a week mustering the courage to send it to me because she was scared to let someone on the outside see what was on her inside. Eventually, she printed it out and left it on her husband's pillow. She was heartbroken when he didn't mention it for 3 weeks. Then, one night, she found an invitation from him asking her to go to a marriage retreat. They could both imagine something more beautiful, it turned out. They were ready to try to make it real. Danielle wrote back to me from her son's hospital bedside after I asked her about the truest, most beautiful story about parenting she could imagine. She said this, "I've spent the past week considering your question. I can imagine 1,000 easier stories about mothers and sons. I can think of 1,000,000 happier ones. But I cannot imagine a single story truer or more beautiful than the heartbreaking one I'm living now with my boys." "Me neither," I wrote back. "Me neither. The truest, most beautiful life never promises to be an easy one. We need to let go of the lie that it's supposed to be." Each of those women has begun to live from her imagination. Here's how. Each honored her own discontent. She did not dismiss it, bury it, deflect it, deny it, blame it on someone else, or tell herself to shut up and be grateful. She heard her knowing whisper, "Not this," and she admitted to herself that she heard it. She sat with it for a while. Then she dared to utter her inner whisper out loud. She shared her discontent with another human being. Then, when she was ready to move from "not this" to "this" instead, she dared to call upon her imagination to tell her the story she was born to tell with her life. She dreamed up what it would look like to have her specific version of truth and beauty come to life. She looked for the blueprint she'd been born with, the one she'd forgotten existed. She unearthed her unseen order, her original plan. Then, and this is crucial, she put pen to paper. The people who build their truest, most beautiful lives usually do. It's hard to jump from dreaming to doing. As every architect or designer knows, there is a critical step between vision and reality. Before imagination becomes three-dimensional, it usually needs to become two-dimensional. It's as though the unseen order needs to come to life one dimension at a time. Women have sent me so many of their two-dimensional dreams over the years. They say, for me, the truest, most beautiful life, family, world looks like. I marvel at how wildly different each of their stories is. It's proof that our lives were never meant to be cookie-cutter, culturally constructed carbon copies of some ideal. There is no one way to live, love, raise children, arrange a family, run a school, a